à Emmanuel Alloa qui a pu nous rejoindre. Merci beaucoup d'avoir fait cette prestation acrobatique pour être là avec nous aujourd'hui. Il nous rejoint directement de Suisse, là où l'enseigne l'université Saint-Gallen. Donc merci. Et donc, je suis particulièrement heureuse qu'il ait pu nous rejoindre. Emmanuel, c'est un de ces jeunes chercheurs vraiment global. Et il s'est formé entre l'Allemagne, la France, l'Italie et maintenant la Suisse. Il dirige chez les Presses du Réel une collection très très belle qui s'intitule...
Perception.
Une collection un peu byzantine avec une belle couverture dorée consacrée au thème de l'image, à la théorie de l'image. Et il est l'auteur aussi d'un livre sur Merleau-Ponty, La résistance du sensible, qui a été traduit en chinois, en espagnol, en anglais. Et donc aujourd'hui, Emmanuel nous présente une intervention au titre déjà qui anticipe déjà une riche discussion qu'on pourra avoir, vu les prémices de cette journée. Post-truth and the epistemological retour à l'ordre in defense of perspectivism. Voilà, merci Emmanuel.
Merci beaucoup. Merci à vous. Tous les organisateurs, à Enrico, Maurizio, Angela. Merci beaucoup d'être là et je m'excuse encore une fois pour ce retard. J'ai essayé de remplir mes fonctions institutionnelles et pédagogiques. So I will start right away, and since we're going to talk about post-truth, maybe let me start with a true story. So the TV series Fargo starts off in the exact same way as the movie of that same name from 1996 by the Coen brothers, cult movie. So the TV drama, just as the movie, starts off with a warning. It was aired in 2014, a warning which says, this is a true story. Before the crime anthology starts, on the backdrop of the deserted snowy landscapes of a wintry Midwest, the following words are to be read. The events depicted in this film took place in Minnesota in 1987. At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed out of respect for the dead. The rest has been told exactly as it occurred. Much of the aura around the Fargo series has to do with this sense of authenticity and this piecemeal reconstruction of the macabre events set in this landscape of claustrophobic emptiness of the Upper Plains. At the same time, a quasi-religious attitude of reverence and recollection is implicitly required of the beholder out of respect of the dead, for the dead. Yet, as some journalists pointed out, the grisly murders depicted in Fargo never took place. Though, as a matter of fact, if one had read the credits carefully, one would have noticed the tiny print disclaimer explaining that the crime thriller is a complete work of fiction. The Fargo case is telling, as it foreshadowed a development which ultimately led the Oxford Dictionaries to declare post-truth to be the word of the year 2016. In a regime of post-truth, truth no longer matters, as its opponents bemoan, and delusional narratives can proliferate in rank growth. However, maybe a more precise description rather than post-truth would be that of the already mentioned alternative truth, or alt-truth, as some like to say. Since the point is not so much to get rid of the claim of truth altogether, but rather to reshape the possibilities of accounting for it and give it the place it deserves. As The Economist put it in an editorial in September 2016, I quote, truth is not falsified or contested, but of secondary importance, end of quote. Unlike many Hollywood dramas, Fargo, both the movie and the TV series, does not draw on the customary announcement based on a true story. No, it claims to be a true story. This is a true story, whatever this means. How can a relationship between factual truth and narrative be organized? Do facts tolerate storytelling at all? Eventually, the filmmakers responded to the accusations of taking liberties with the truth, since his storyboard was at best Since their storyboard was at best inspired by remotely resembling murder cases that directors had freely recombined. As Ethan Coen explains apologetically, I quote, "We wanted to make a movie, just in the genre of a true story movie. You don't have to have a true story in order to have to make a true story movie." End of quote. Has truth become the question of a specific genre, thus? A strategy of play acting? What does truth look like? And how to produce something that is made in its image and likeness? Filmic fiction is an exemplary laboratory, as it were, which allows to observe transformations that are occurring more broadly on a societal level. The question of truth has primarily resurfaced as a central controversial topic in political issues, such as the Russian invasion of the Crimea, the use of chemical weapons in the Syrian war, the call for a Brexit in the UK, and more than anything during the US-American presidential campaign. It was Vladimir Putin, all the while his soldiers were marching in the Crimean Peninsula, who impassively went on TV claiming that no single Russian soldier was present on the Ukrainian territory. It's the UKIP pro-Brexit campaigners spreading the voice that the UK is unidirectionally sending £350 million to Brussels, which it never sees again. It is Donald Trump asserting that he had seen thousands of Muslims in New Jersey rejoicing because of the collapsing of the Twin Towers, or his famous advisor Kellyanne Conway talking about the massacres of Bowling Green, which, as you know, never took place. So the circumstantial detail that these statements turn out to be blatantly false seem not to have been detrimental in any serious way to their authors, and this bespeaks a sea change in the general mindset. As the Oxford Committee explained in the justification for their choice of post-truth as the word of the year, I quote, "Objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief." End of quote. It's quite interesting, this description. So a lot seems to indicate here, indeed, that there is a rising distrust of experts' opinion and a general desire for what has been branded as new sincerity, or even more precisely as truthiness, to use this wonderful concept Stephen Colbert coined. Just as in the Fargo case, where it was all about making something in the genre of truth, of a true movie, what is of primary importance is to appear truthful. And a very useful resource, which I recommend to you all, a book if you really want to understand what we're going through, is a book which came out in 2009. It's called A Playing to Win in Work and Life. That's the subtitle, and the main title is The Trump Card, and the author is no one else than Ivanka Trump. I really recommend it to you. So Ivanka Trump, if she has written it herself, states the following, I quote, "Perception is more important than reality. If someone perceives something to be true, it is more important than if it is in fact true. This doesn't mean that you should be duplicitous or deceitful, but don't go out of your way to correct a false assumption if it plays to your advantage." So this is the answer to the authoritarian problem of truth or of deceit. End of quote. Such an understanding, I believe, tallies rather well with Niccolo Machiavelli's advices given to the prince in 15th century Florence. No one seems to have learned this neo-Machiavellian lesson better than Ivanka's own father. Disregarding what philosophers criticized as the correspondence theory of truth, the famous adequatio of words and things, Donald Trump sides with a rather performative understanding of speech, as his twittering behavior confirms. And I believe if anyone ever needed a better example of what performative and what performative speech acts are about, or maybe elocutionary effects, the way in which John Searle rephrased this is the Twitter messages by Donald Trump. It's 140 characters at most. And with 140 characters, someone like Donald Trump will comment something on Lockheed Martin's latest fighter, and this will lead to a drop of $350 billion on the stock market exchanges. This is the best example of what performatives are about. So these short statements, I think, show us why language is not about facts, actually,
But language is something that produces facts, states of affairs. It is, rather than factual, it is factative, as I like to call it. It is something that brings about the reality it bespeaks. Second point, fighting back and the epistemological retour à l'ordre. Such barefaced disregard for things as they are has stirred numerous reactions, and the initiative of this very conference is to be counted among them. Many public and private actors are increasingly worried about the effects of the post-factual on epistemological and ethical issues and try to find conceptual means to fight back. As you know, number one sales worldwide in books is George Orwell's dystopia 1984. I think it's a very interesting fact. So they are skyrocketing the sales 1984, and this alleged crisis of truth is also something that has stirred the reactions of tech giants, global players from the Silicon Valley, introducing something like algorithmic filters for spotting fake news and the like. And of course, I'm not going to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about what is happening on the intellectual front, where the main reaction was to designate the culprit. We all know who's responsible for this general disaster, which has led us to Donald Trump and populism in general. It is relativism and the driving force working in its back, postmodernism. I'll just name a few examples here. According to the Scientific American's columnist, I quote, "By undermining science's claim to objectivity, these postmodernists have unwittingly laid the philosophical foundation for the new rise of authoritarianism," end of quote. In a similar vein, the media intellectual Kenan Malik explains that, I quote, "sections of academia and on the left have in recent decades helped create a culture in which relativized views of facts and knowledge seem untroubling, and hence made it easier for the reactionary right not just to reappropriate, but also to promote reactionary ideas," end of quote. As Daniel Dennett put it, "I think what the postmodernists did was truly evil. They are responsible for the intellectual fad that made it respectable to be cynical about truth and facts. You'd have people going around and saying, well, you're part of that crowd who still believes in facts," end of quote. And the Russian-born critic Peter Pomerantsev texts along similar lines when he states in an opinion paper titled "Why We're Post-Fact," "This equaling out of truth and falsehood is both informed by and takes advantage of all of the all-permeating late postmodernism and relativism." But of course, the author who perhaps mobilizes this argument most forcefully and systematically is, of course, Maurizio Ferraris. In his Manifesto for New Realism, he has been among the first to actually describe this shift, what postmodernism's didn't even dare to dream about in their wildest dreams. This is what populism has realized. This sentence has since then been often quoted. And what I find interesting is that both in Maurizio's account and in Pomerantsev, Dennett's, and other ones, beyond this general designation of the wrongdoers, there is a name here that is being designated as the main culprit, and this is Friedrich Nietzsche. So
what?
Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So you heard about it. So he's, I quote from the Manifesto for New Realism, the real problem is not God is dead, but rather the sentence "there are no facts, only interpretations," because the real world ended up being a tale. And that's what postmodernism has mainly taken from Nietzsche. At first blush, of course, and I'll stop here at the long list, I could continue on many other people who have similar claims, this description is, of course, very accurate, and it bespeaks a certain state of affairs. When subscribing to the statement that there are no facts, only interpretations, critique will have to ground arms, so it seems. When a journalist confronted her with the fact that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer had grossly misstated the figures concerning the people present at Donald Trump's inauguration, Trump's advisor Kellyanne Conway contested that Spicer had been wrong, minting in passing an expression which has since then entered the lexicon. One must grant the possibility, Conway pleaded, of something like alternative fact.
The episode is telling, as it confirms that an obscurantist backlash takes place in the very name of tolerance and the hospitable accommodation of plural opinions. Contrary to what Nietzsche saw as the coming bacchanal of free spirits, a pluralism of perspectives seems to pave the ground for regressive politics, not by accident. At the rally in Nevada in February 2016, Donald Trump outspokenly confessed preferring, I quote, the poorly educated. I think this says a lot. At large, conspiracy theories are making the great comeback with the rise of creationism, vaccine hostility, or climate denial. And what is significant is that this time they wield the banner of emancipation from imposed narratives. No one has ever invoked as often the need for pluralism as the advocates of alternative truth. No one has ever called for democratic freedom of speech more often invoked democratic freedom of speech than xenophobic isolationists. Conspiracy hypotheses such as that about the U.S. moon landing never taking place because it was in fact staged in a Hollywood studio look innocuous in contrast to the current political momentum of revisionist positions. While high U.S. government officials discuss the need to introduce creationist teaching in school curricula, and governmentally funded agencies for climate research are shut down on the pretense that climate change predictions are not uncontroversial, the effect of the shift are palpable. History becomes a welcome reservoir for weighing in on the present. For example, when conservative media pundits such as Glenn Beck and evangelical activists such as David Wharton claim that the founding fathers have already proven evolutionary theory to be wrong. I always find this really beautiful because supposedly Thomas Jefferson proved that Darwin's theories were wrong, but actually he published them 33 years after Jefferson's death. But okay, this is just a detail. This rewriting of history is not only an American prerogative, by the way. Rio de Janeiro's main new mayor thinks that Darwinism is a lie and that evolutionary theory should be replaced with creationism on the grounds of freedom of speech. Just as in Turkey, the official position does not recognize the genocidal killings of 1.5 million Armenians under the guise that other alternative memories of these years should be possible too, which makes place for sufferings on the other side too. So these many symptoms, I don't need to tell you, these many symptoms tell us that something is very wary here. And the question is, of course, what kind of intellectual response do we want to have here? Against Donald Trump's allegation that global warming is a Chinese hoax in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive, or education ministers who claim that the world was created 6,000 years ago, there seem to be good reasons for upholding something such as the existence of an objective reality. And as we know, relativism is self-contradictory for metaphysical as well as for political reasons. For metaphysical reasons, since it defeats itself, as the master argument always invoked by the realists goes, to say there is no truth annuls itself when applied to the claim itself. If relativism is just one among many other possible opinions one may hold, why should we have any reason to accept it rather than its negation? This is well known, but relativism is also self-contradictory for political reasons, since rather than fostering openness, as we see today, it muzzles critique and leads to regression. Under the disguise of stressing interdependence, relativism actually promotes hegemony. Yet from this double rejection of relativism, no necessary need for realism follows if we mean by realism the existence of a reality that would be thoroughly independent from our relationship to it. Falling back into direct realism would be almost as fatal as the relativism stigmatized before. And there was this interesting case, I don't know if all of you are familiar, the debate between John Searle and Hilary Lawson. So in a way, John Searle repeats what Apple CEO Tim Cook had replied to Kellyanne Conway. Tim Cook said, the problem is not about alternative facts. There are no alternative facts. There are only alternative interpretations. So facts are simple. The problem is how we have to interpret them. So this is, of course, the distinction, which I probably don't need to restate here between epistemological dimensions, which have to do with the knowledge of a fact, and ontological dimensions, which have to do with the existence of a fact. So the top of Everest is going to be covered with snow, even if no one knows about it. And in this sense, ontology precedes epistemology. This is where John Searle sides with Maurizio Ferraris. Moreover, we must distinguish ontological facts and the statements about them. One must disagree whether Rembrandt is the greatest painter who ever lived, but there are no objective grounds to disagree that Rembrandt was born in 1606. This is the example John Searle uses. So the very claim of ontological objectivity for the statement Rembrandt was born in 1606 rests on a tight web of social references, actually, as Hilary Lawson rightly replied, I believe. Depending on the social convention, different calendars will be used, Chinese, Gregorian, Julian, Islamic, and so forth, and each will provide a variety of dates for Rembrandt's birth. Just as it would be absurd to claim that the October Revolution took actually place in November, just because we follow a Gregorian calendar. How do we make sure in which month the revolution took place? It doesn't make sense. The whole debate doesn't make sense. Similarly, statements such as Rembrandt was born is also not straightforward, since an art historian might very well argue that the individual that was to become Rembrandt was indeed born in 1606. But the great artist we know as Rembrandt was not born until at least the 1630s. In the same vein, one might imagine a cultural theorist beginning a lecture saying Rembrandt was born along with the first cave painting some 35,000 years ago. So as it becomes clear, there is a certain range of alternative dates that compete for truth. All of this doesn't really distress any realist, but he will have to find criteria for distinguishing primary truth and that derived truth or metaphorical truths. So we'll have to find out what is actually the core fact and derived interpretations. However, I believe the very distinction between core and derived truths is itself the result of a social practice. So there is a problem here with the appeal to common sense. The common sense, Rembrandt was of course born in 1606, the door is open, the door is shut. This appeal to common sense, I believe, is tricky. Why is it tricky? Because Paris is the capital of France, or these are my hands, you know, we could make similar cases here, are only superficially obvious and are de facto persuasive because they are embedded in commonly shared practices. So it actually proves the opposite position to be true. In other terms, the appeal to common sense may be just as populist as the politics, a certain strand of realism one to contest. Disconnecting ontology from epistemology and reverting to a situation of separation, such as we knew it from pre-Kantian philosophy, is, to say the least, a move that is far from being innocent. Ultimately, such philosophical and epistemological retour à l'ordre threatens then the important social and political advances gained through the idea of perspectivism, which, just said in passing, Paul would probably also easily recognize that there were advances, social and political advances, that were made possible, progressive movements such as post-colonialism and multiculturalism, on the very assumption that there can be something like a constructivist approach to reality. This is what he explains in Fear of Knowledge. So I now come to the two claims that I want to discuss here. And I'm not sure I have time to discuss both of the claims. The first claim is that Donald Trump is a relativist. And I'm not sure about this. And the second claim is that perspectivism is a relativism. I can also summarize maybe the Trump part.
We have time because we have a technical problem for the
video,
so we can, if you want to develop 10, 15 more minutes, and then we can
Okay, then let me come to the first question, the question of Trump.
We're all, I guess, trying to figure out what this guy's positions are about. The major puzzle of today. So it has been claimed that Donald Trump actually epitomizes this entry into the post-truth politics age, and that post-truth politics is tantamount with the general dismissal of the real. Before coming to the second point, we have to clarify what is meant by post-truth politics. As in point of fact, post-truth politics may cover a wide range of different phenomena. And the first one is to make claims that are outrageously false, as Donald Trump undoubtedly champions Donald Trump undoubtedly champions in this category, with a long list of examples that could be made here throughout his campaign, but also in his presidential address, with a number of wrong statements concerning immigrants, health insurance, military spending, or the economic situation at large. But another feature of post-truth is to pamper in expressions that are, by and large, either trivial or meaningless. We might consider not just Donald Trump, but other prominent politicians. Thinks of Theresa May permanently repeating the sentence "Brexit is Brexit" to the point of emptying the sentence to pure tautology. Or when she adds, "I want a red, white, and blue Brexit." Whatever that means, to tell that the United Kingdom is supposed to leave the European Union under the guise of the colors of United Kingdom. So there is a kind of emptying of language that I think explains maybe why people turn to George Orwell to understand this emptying of language today. Another aspect, I think, is the proclivity to use phrases which, technically speaking, have no propositional truth value. So I think it's not enough to just discuss the blatant lies. It's also other forms of language games that are being played here that don't have a propositional truth value, such as a hope. Remember the French presidential campaign towards the end of the debate. Marine Le Pen made an allegation about, "I hope we don't find out about your bank account in the Bahamas." This doesn't have a propositionally, technically speaking, a propositional truth value. It's a hope. As we know from Aristotle, de interpretatione, hopes, just as other forms of expression of desire, don't have a truth value. And yet they are having a tremendous effect on what truth is. And of course, all these allegations and expressions of hope we can find in Donald Trump's Twitter messages. "I hope we won't find out at some point that," and so on and so forth. So all of these plays with truth constitute a sort of disregard for what is the fact, for what is real. The question is, What is the specific relationship that someone like Donald Trump entertains with reality? As I see it, there are two interpretations to account for his relationship to truth. The first one is, I would call it, the bullshit scenario. Maybe some of you know the book by Harry Frankfurt. So what Harry Frankfurt says, that the point about the bullshitter is that the bullshitter, as opposed to the liar, does not relate to truth at all. So liars at least want to force the opponent into a certain opinion. They want to steer them. They want to lead them to either believe or uphold a certain position. This is not the case of the bullshitter. The bullshitter is bullshitting, and by bullshitting, he signals his total disinterest in the very idea of truth. He hollows out the very pretense to truth. He doesn't care whether the things he says describe reality correctly. He just picks them out or makes them up to suit his purpose. And this is all of this is to convey a certain impression. So if Frankfurt's analysis can be applied to Donald Trump, as many assert, then it would be, I think, more accurate to describe him as a non-realist than as an anti-realist if the very point about bullshitting is that bullshitting is not an anti-realist position, it's a non-realist position. So if the bullshit scenario is correct, then Donald Trump is a non-realist and not an anti-realist, as it has been claimed. But can it really be claimed that Donald Trump gave up on any notion of reality that would not be instrumental? In a way, his alleged relativism is served by crude political realism in the sense Mao Zedong defined it: political power grows out of the barrel of a gun, as you know. Yet this turns power into truth. And one might call in another famous quote by Ernest Hemingway here, who has Christ and fascism to be allied, told by bullies. So all of this we'll have to discuss is the question of the connection between truth or knowledge and power, which is, I think, very, very central here. But I'd like to suggest a second alternative scenario beyond the bullshit scenario, and this one is inspired by Theodor Adorno. And I call it the insolence scenario.
Which?
Insolence.
Yeah.
In Minima Moralia, so a book written towards the end of World War II, we find passages which very strangely resonate with our times today. So what Adorno says is the following: among today's adept practitioners, the lie has long since lost its honest function of misrepresenting reality. Nobody believes anybody, everybody is in the know. Lies are told only to convey to someone that one has no need either of him or his good opinion. The lie, once a liberal means of communication, has today become one of the techniques of insolence, enabling each individual to spread around him the glacial atmosphere in whose shelter he can thrive. End of quote. I think it's a brilliant description. While according to Adorno, the lie used to be a tool of dissimulation and manipulation, now it operates in blatant transparency, which does not mean that no manipulation takes place any longer, rather that we are faced with the phenomenon of insolence. Adorno observes a social world which has stripped off its delusional character, since by now everybody is in the picture, everybody is in the know. What does not mean that lying would have become impossible. Rather, it is the aim of lying which has changed, as Christoph Parret has recently argued. Rather than trying to steer the other into a certain direction and make him endorse a certain opinion, the blatant lie displays a total disinterest in the other's opinions. The civil type of lie, which Adorno seems to bemoan, kept up appearances as it pretended to respect the other. The insolent lie, on the contrary, is just a way of downplaying the other. On a higher order level, we could say that Donald Trump even takes a further step when his type of insolence consists in calling all his adversaries lies. You know that he said that Hillary Clinton is the liar. Yeah. So whatever one may draw as a kind of conclusion from all of this, and I leave it open, I don't have a conclusive take on this. I'm just offering a few scenarios here. I think one conclusion cannot be drawn from it. Despite the appearances, a regime of insolence doesn't do away with the notion of truth. The unashamed show of force might disregard the other's opinions and consider it isn't even necessary to convince the interlocutor, yet the claim to truth remains. In a certain sense, the insolent gesture consists in an open disregard of divergent opinions. It also can be seen as tantamount to affirming a certain kind of uncontestable truth. And maybe this whole position can be wonderfully summarized by Groucho Marx's observation: who are you going to believe, your eyes or me? You know, and I think this says it all. This summarizes it beautifully. And I will even add a further reflection. Are we really so sure about the fact that Donald Trump is a relativist? You remember his most preferred metaphor, draining the swamp. Can you really be a relativist and at the same time claim that you're going to clear this Washington swamp, this muddy, fishy waters, if you don't believe that at some point you will get down
to solid grounds below. As you can see, all these psychosocial inquiries are not conclusive, and this is not my expertise, and I leave it to others. I just was trying to make some forays here into a problem that I believe at least bothers myself. But I think we have to be very cautious about the all too hasty conclusion that Donald Trump is an anti-realist. That's for sure. But let me move now to the second, more philosophical point, and explain the plea I want to make here. And of course, it's an invitation to all our friends and colleagues here. So in defense of perspectivism, and the assumption that perspectivism is a kind of relativism, as has been aired quite frequently these last months and years. What is perspectivism? For a long time, perspectivism was associated with alternative takes on things. To be able to envision, to change perspectives meant to be able to consider the possibility that the matter could be different. So perspectivism, in a nutshell, sided with alternativity. And I think this is a phenomenon we haven't fully acknowledged yet. But there has been a hijacking of the very notion of alternativity. And this is a very dangerous and problematic phenomenon. Just think of it. For a long time, the conservative position was associated with the claim that there are no alternatives. Think of Margaret Thatcher's politics of the TINA principle. TINA as there is no alternative. It has to be that way. It can't be discussed. Progressive politics were traditionally associated with the defense of something like alternativity. It could be different. The what-if question. What if things were different? What about considering a different state of affairs? The what-if was a main tool in utopian politics, in progressive politics, in politics that meant to change things for the better. We observe that the what-if phrase has now been hijacked by positions that are highly regressive. It's the conspiracy theories. What if things were actually different? What if things were being hidden from us? Maybe some of you remember the TV series X-Files from the 90s with these iconic agents Mulder and Scully. Do you remember the slogan? Truth is out there. Exactly. Truth is out there. So truth is out there is very different from the way in which the epistemologists tell us that reality is out there. The out there is not just in front of us. The out there is in a far remove. And someone is hiding the truth from us. So the hijacking of alternativity happens in phrases such as alt-truth, alt-reality, and of course, more generally, in alt-right, the alternative right. As mentioned, a certain number of critical intellectuals have blamed the fault on Nietzschean perspectivism, and in particular on the aphorism in Truth and Lie in an Extra-Moral Sense, according to which there are no facts, only interpretations. This often quoted statement, as mentioned before, is of course self-defeating. We all know, as any general relativist statement, it must also include itself, which would mean that the fact that there are only interpretations is itself an interpretation, so it's not a fact, and of course, this is where it has to stop. But is the kind of interpretationism for which the Nietzsche later in the fragments on the Will to Power uses the expression perspectivism really a relativism? I'm not so sure. Is it true that the early Nietzsche, it's quite obvious that the early Nietzsche, the Nietzsche from Weit und Lügen außer moralischen Sinne, from which the often quoted passage comes, where truth is defined as a mobile army of metaphors, devised something like their artist metaphysics. So this kind of general relativity can only be overcome by a move which is that of the artist creating something like a new reality. But if we read Nietzsche more closely, we'll find out that he himself evolved on the matter, and that his own take on perspectivism changed. And as a matter of fact, he uses the word perspectivism to describe what he wants to overcome, interestingly. So we have to make a difference between perspectivism as a diagnosis for what is wrong in talking about perspectives, and the kind of perspectivism that Nietzsche himself was practicing. Let's just confront this passage from Weidenlügen aus dem römischen Sinne with a passage from the Antichrist. What he says is the following. He's praising the art of reading. He's praising the philologists for being able to read off a fact without falsifying it by interpretation, without losing caution, patience, subtlety in the desire for understanding. I think it's difficult to believe that someone who writes this kind of thing is a relativist. And this is why the philologist, by the way, says Nietzsche parts with the theologian who is not only incapable of reading, but also is motivated by a deeply embodied, I quote, compulsion to lie. But I'll leave this aside. It is time to revise the myth according to which Nietzsche would be some sort of prophet of an unrestricted anything goes. On the contrary, Nietzsche rather stigmatizes those who believe that once the knowability of the thing itself has become questionable, we are left with the jolly dance of whirling appearances alone. As it happens, if we affirm this kind of infinity of mere appearances of a society of pure spectacle, we remain caught in a metaphysical dualism, and Nietzsche openly scolds the naive and comfortable perspectivism which affirms that each and everyone has different perspectives. Since once you affirm this, you know, it's fine. You have your perspective. I have my perspective. The only thing we have to do is kind of find a meta perspective from which we can then talk with each other. And interestingly, this perspective, well, is very hegemonic. And this, he refers it back to Hobbes's Leviathan. He calls it the fixe convention. So it's this kind of affirming of there are only appearances everywhere. But of course, you know, we have to get along. So we have to fix boundaries. It reminds me of Jerusalem today. You know, we all disagree on everything, but actually we can work along quite well. And this leads to a very rigid consideration of how things should be. So an ambitious perspectivism claims all the contrary in Nietzsche. And this ambitious perspectivism is about, of course, what truth means. As Nietzsche writes in a letter to Fuchs from August 1888, what is correct can be ascertained in innumerable cases. It is only what is correct which is so much harder to ascertain, and as a matter of fact, it almost never happens. As he goes on, in the genealogy of morals, beyond the ironic picture devised by the liberal perspective, experiences force us to rethink our comfortable position. By the way, he also has this expression where he says, truth is cruel. There's a cruelty of truth, and there's even something violent to truth which forces us to change our perspective. So it's not just a matter of choice whether we want to side with truth or with the lie. It's also something that is imposed on us whether we like it or not. And this is what he calls the change of perspective. Precisely because we seek knowledge, let us not be ungrateful to such resolute reversals of accustomed perspective and valuations with which the spirit has, for apparent mischievousness and futility, raged against itself so long. And significantly, the displacement of one's own perspective is not just a matter of personal subjective growth, but a first step towards objectivity. To see differently in this way for once, to want to see differently in no small discipline and preparation of the intellect for its future objectivity. And here it comes. Nietzsche, the late Nietzsche, uses the word objectivity as one of the crucial key points of his own endeavor. The question is how to reach this objectivity in a different way. We haven't been giving up on objectivity. We've just given up on actually a wrong concept of objectivity. So how do we attain objectivity? What he criticizes is this idea of a colorless, bodiless, positionless contemplation of objectivity. Where is je finis? Est-ce que fini? So in other terms, he says we have to get beyond the idea that it can be contemplation without interest, which is of course a nonsensical absurdity. but as the ability, he says, to control one's pros and cons and to dispose of them so that one knows how to enjoy and to employ a variety of perspectives and effective interpretations in the service of knowledge. What is he saying here? What he's saying is that we need to pluralize the perspectives. It's not that we need to pluralize the facts. It's not that we need to have alternative facts. This kind of internal plurality that we have to accept, which is going to lead to a much better, precise account of what objectivity is. We have to intensify, pluralize, multiply the perspectives, which will give a much better picture of what objectivity is, of how things are. This, he says, is the true conclusion we derive from perspectivity. There is only, I quote again, a perspectival seeing, only a perspective knowing, and the more effects we allow to speak about one thing, the more eyes, different eyes, we can use to observe one thing, the more complete will our concept of this thing, our objectivity, be. This is on the genealogy of morals. I think this observation, this Nietzsche's observation, is more valid than ever in those hypocritical times when the name of alternativity and plurality were actually paving the way for a general closing of the minds.
Emmanuel, il y a déjà beaucoup de questions, donc on a encore une demi-heure. Je propose qu'on fasse 15 minutes de discussion ensemble et après on laisse les conclusions à Maurice, les perspectives surtout.
Merci.
Alors, Paul Bossian, Enrico Terrone, John Searle et Julian Nida. Et oui. Maurice, tu peux pas grouper avec tes conclusions la remarque pour Emmanuel, peut-être? Parce
oui,
que
peut-être.
Sinon on va pas. Ok.
Okay.
So, a couple of things. The bullshit thing, not having any relation to truth, and therefore, since if you're a bullshit artist, that means you've somehow given up on the notion of truth. You have to remember, bullshitting is a speech act.
Of course.
So this doesn't mean anything about, it doesn't imply anything about belief. What you do when you bullshit people, if you say things to have a certain kind of effect, as far as what you believe, that can be as realist as you want. In fact, you're often bullshitting precisely because you know one thing to be true, but you want other people to be confused. So, and that also bears on the question, is Donald Trump a relativist? That's really not the issue. Donald Trump what is important is that in teaching generation after generation of undergraduates that there was reason to be suspicious of something called the truth, you give a tool to people who want to manipulate by saying to them, look, don't object to me when I do these policies that look like they're going to ruin the planet by saying science has proven such and such a thing because, that notion is suspect. That's a tool that people can cynically use. So you don't have to be a relativist in order to use relativistic tools to accomplish your end. But the thing that I didn't get at the end is, what is it exactly that we are pluralizing and why should we do it? What is that? So you were not pluralizing facts or truths, but...
Well, we are pluralizing.
Why are we pluralizing?
Well, to begin with, thank you. So first comment on Harry Frankfurt. I think you. I'm very grateful you brought this up because I left it out for the sake of time. But I think Harry Frankfurt himself didn't realize that the point about bullshitting is about performatives and is not about the question of being right or being wrong. And I think he was deeply leaving aside that not only people who are bullshitting are producing effects, but they are also there's also a performative speech act which consists of treating someone of being a bullshitter, of saying this is bullshit. So it's the very qualification, tagging something as being bullshit, there's actually already a speech act, and that's part of the kind of language game which I find problematic, which is the one that says, which is very different than saying there are facts and there are truths, from saying this is part of what is to be encircled within the domain of truth, or it is not. So the very fact of saying this is bullshit is, of course, a very different speech act from bullshitting. But I think the philosopher is acting as a policeman here. And I don't think that this kind of hygienistic approach is the one where philosophy is best. So I'm already coming to the second part of the question. So I think we agree on many, many things. So I'm committed to a notion of truth. I'm not so shocked by the notion of truth. I'm committed to fight relativism in all its form. The question is how to achieve this in the best possible way. And I think the first task philosophy has is to introduce questions, and the right questions, and questionings where things seem so obvious. So I'm not sure that we should be solving or addressing those attitudes that are to say, well, I don't know a thing, you know, maybe things could be different, people could be hiding realities from us, by saying, well, but I can tell you a number of things. The Earth is spherical. Is it? I don't know. I don't think the philosopher's position is to say that the Earth is spherical. It's actually elliptic more than spherical. But I don't think. But that's not the point. I don't think it's about. It's the strong that philosophy is strongest when it restates the facts. And I think we should evade this trap. Which is the most easy way today is to say, look, but guys, there are things happening. The Earth is not flat. The Earth was not created 6,000 years ago, and all of these things. It seems like an urgency, and I sometimes have that drive too. But I think we have to fight other wars. But maybe you're going to tell me why I'm wrong.
Look, the commitment to facts is not a commitment to any specific thing. For all I know, the Earth is elliptical or spherical or whatever. It's a commitment to there being a fact of the matter that is not a function of human belief. That's what the commitment is. I'm not really understanding what you were doing with all that. But the main thing I wanted to find out is what you talked about the importance of pluralizing perspectives, mm-hmm. but that wasn't supposed to amount to pluralizing facts or pluralizing truth or. And I just wanted to know what it was.
Okay. So I'm.
What do you think that recommendation was? Mm-hmm.
So I'm not using the distinction between norms and facts, for example. So I don't think it's a useful distinction. I don't think it's a useful distinction to use the distinction between social and physical. We had this discussion last time. So the reason being that if we believe that social institutions and the criteria that Maurizio introduced of the unamendable, which is to say that there are social realities are realities that can be modified, whereas physical realities are realities that can't be. I think the classical examples of speech act show us that this is not the case. I can of course. When under certain circumstances, socially described circumstances, someone is declared as man and husband and wife, this social reality can be undone socially. But of course, this undoing will not never revert to pristine virgin status that it had before. If you undo this relationship, you will be divorced. You will not come back to a situation which you can't undo. So there are a number of reasons why I personally prefer not to make such a strong division between the social and the ontological. Social events, facts, norms are things that have ontological bearings. What I'm basically doing here is questioning a number of very strictly marked differences that were reintroduced these last years that I find not so useful, which is that between epistemology and ontology, that between the social and the physical, and that between the normative and the factual. That's...
I agree with almost everything you said, but there's one thing I profoundly disagree with, and I'm not
I hope
sure
so.
To admit it, because it sounded kind of bashful when you said it. So let me get it out in the open. The fact that all of our utterances are made from a point of view, within a perspective, using a conceptual apparatus, does not by itself imply any form of relativism. Let me go through one of your examples. The Earth is 93 million miles from the Sun, but if you measure it in kilometers, it comes out as what? They must have taught you this in the lycée. 100, I guess it'd be 150 million kilometers. So which is it? Is the Earth 150 million or 93 million? And the answer is both are true. There's no inconsistency. Alternative systems of representation do not by themselves imply any form of relativism. And you seem to be saying that. So perspectivalism, there's a harmless way of stating it where it's perfectly consistent with the most naive and absolute conception of metaphysical realism. And that says, of course, all utterances are made within a conceptual apparatus from a perspective using a certain set of categories. No, so far, no relativism is implied. That's absolute, that is perfectly consistent with with an absolutist, non-relativist conception of truth. Now, we're in France, and I have, from time to time, had various debates. I'm sure you guys never heard of this, but there was a guy, Limoges Jacques. He's up now, Derrida. And I had a debate with him. Now, I had some other, Copin, Michel. Michel Foucault hated Limoges Jacques much more than I ever did. It was Michel who said, he practiced the la méthode de l'obscurantisme terroriste. And I said, qu'est-ce que ça veut dire exactement, obscurantisme terroriste? He said, he is so obscure, you can't understand him. So when you criticize him, he says, vous m'avez mal compris, vous êtes idiot. That's the terrorism part. He practices the method of obscurantisme terroriste. Now, I think it's very upsetting to an intelligent, serious, professional intellectual like Michel Foucault, to put him in bed with Limoges Jacques. It was just disgusting to him. And I once said to him, I mean, this is somewhat irrelevant, but I think it may be useful. I said to him, pourquoi tu écris si mal? Well, you're perfectly clear-headed in conversation. Why do you write so badly? And he then explained to me, with the patience that you have in dealing with les enfants, he said, if I wrote as clearly as you do, no one in Paris would take me seriously. I said, oh, come on, tu te moques un peu de moi, qu'est-ce que ça veut dire? And he said, no. En France, à Paris, he said, à Paris, il faut avoir au moins 10% incompréhensible. So I was teaching at the Collège de France, and I told this a story to what's the name of my friend there, the successor of
Jacques Bouvresse.
What?
Bouvresse.
Not Bouvresse. No, that's another story. that's another story. This is a nice guy who died recently. I'm awfully sorry to say. Anyway, I asked him, alors, 10%, c'est comme ça. I said, beaucoup pire que ça. Au moins 20%. Anyway, I'm sorry I digressed to local cultural phenomena, but the main point I want to get across is the relativism of the system of representation does not imply any kind of relativism about truth or reality.
If this helped to clarify one thing, then that I hadn't been clear enough, and maybe it was my French part, 10%, 80%, whatever. What I wanted to say is that perspectivism is not a relativism. And the second part of your question made me also think that we could discuss the notion of representation. So that's the other thing I want to get rid of. I don't think it's
about... You want to get rid of representation?
Yes.
You won't do much talking.
So I think that's something that is part of the whole problem of
Another claim that I find quite problematic is the claim that the language is not about facts and produces facts. It seems to me there are two different functions of language. They are both functions of language. Sometimes language is about facts when we describe things. Other times, in declarative speech acts, instead of assertive speech acts, language produces facts. But there are both. So it's the same is for pictures. So you're right, Fargo is not about facts, it produces facts. But the recording we are doing now is not producing facts. It's about facts. It's recording what is going on there. So it's just two functions. So I can also understand perspective in this sense. Say you should not just focus on things how they are, but also on how things might be. Fine. It's opposite. One just the truth is not saying that we should accept what is true. We can want to change it, but it's just there are two completely compatible things. So we have truth and how things are. And then we can have alternatives, imagination, how things may be. And maybe we can, imagining better things, we can change reality. Why not? But I think that it's not an alternative to what you are proposing. It's just saying, guys, of course, the truth is important, objective reality is important, how things are important, but also you should do, it's helpful also to think how things may be. Fine.
Sure.
Why not?
Sure. I think you're right in pointing out that I had misphrased things. So what I meant to say is that every language act, I think, is creating facts. But there are also some of these language acts that are about facts. So I think this is the reason, but I feel a bit uncomfortable speaking here in front of Chancel about this that Austin gave up the very difference about performative and constative. I mean, the whole point is to say that language is performative in and as such, and that's why we have to describe things differently. So there are no constative sentences that will not be performative in some way. That's all I meant to say. So thanks for the clarification. And on the rest, I subscribe to everything you said. Yes, I of course, we can open up different perspectives, which are not just about facts, but how things could be, sure.
Last question?
Well, to the last point, I didn't have the intention to comment it, but if something isn't assertion, speech act, an assertion, doesn't tell that it has nothing to do with reality or the description of reality. The performative nature of spoken language doesn't tell against realism. So that's
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now about perspectivism, you announced perspectivism. You announced a plea for perspectivism mm-hmm. in the defense of Nietzsche. Probably not Nietzsche saying that Wahrheit ist das, was fälschlicherweise dafür gehalten wird. Probably not that. But focus on perspectivism. You said this is perspectivism that is compatible with non-being a relativist. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it meant in that sense? We have a physical object, let's say, in the middle of a room, and 20 persons around, staying out, and they describe that object. And depending on the perspective they have, they describe things, this thing different. From that perspective, it looks like this, from that perspective, it looks like that, and so on and so forth. And maybe if we have different angles from which you look at it, enough perspectives, then somehow you get a clear picture how it is, in fact. And maybe some choose to describe certain aspects, color, others the form, and so on and so forth. So all these perspectives should be compatible with each other. And for this, the realist that all these perspectives, even if no one of these perspectives gives the whole picture, but part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So is this the idea of perspectivism without relativism?
I find it interesting that every time, I mean, philosophy is always about starting point, and no philosophy can justify its own starting point. But of course, it's the question of what is this common sense? What is the obviousness from which we start? Of course, if we start with
the assumption that we have something like a stable, identical object there, which is going to be the matrix for our entire thinking. Of course, we will have to conceive of perspectivalism in this fashion. So enriching the perspectives will just mean that finally we can get beyond our own finitude, individual finitude, finitude as beings, finitude, temporal finitude, historical finitude, and then we can finally do something which is not possible from a single vantage point. But I think this has to do with the fact that, strangely enough, the starting point of such a realist position is that of a medium-sized object that can be grasped by humans as something that is actually knowable, because we go around it, move around it. At some point, we have the impression we've seen it all. I think we have to, if we really want to displace perspectives, and that's the call that Nietzsche is making here, has this beautiful expression where he says, die Ecke schauen. You know, it doesn't really translate into English, but it means both looking around the corner and the fact that Ecke is, what he says, aus der Ecke schauen means from this angle, viewing. So there is no other way. So viewing means always only viewing partially, in part. To see something means not to see everything. There's no big picture. There can't be any big picture. And yet, we shouldn't be modeling our thinking of perspectivity on something that it seems to be obvious to us, which is the medium-sized empirical object that we can move around. Think if we want to give an account of how things are, we have to also to displace our very notion of knowledge. And that is to rethink maybe the very notion of objectivity and not take these kind of objects as the starting point. So I think this pluralization is to begin with has a critical function, which is when Nietzsche says in the genealogy of morals, well, maybe the starting point is to understand that we can't have a full picture. We see it from here. Wir müssen aus dieser Ecke schauen, and that our starting point is not the only one. That's already a lot. This kind of narcissistic fêlure, blessure, is to understand, well, because the infinity we were considering was the infinity from here, and that's the problem. And I think lots of contemporary new ontologies make this example of falling back on this idea, we're going to welcome everybody, but from here. And I think this is not the good vantage point to think of inclusion always starting from where we stand.
Merci beaucoup, Hans and Manuel. Maurice, do you want to...
Excuse me. Yes. The guy whose name I couldn't remember is Pierre Bourdieu.
Heard that name.
But just for the conclusion.
It will be even better. 10 minutes and then you can go home without any. So it's very difficult to me to find a general conclusion of this day that anyway has been very important for me, and I believe also for others here, because we had plenty of ideas. Since it's difficult, I tried in a kind of authoritative way to make a kind of decalogue. No, there is there are previous examples of decalogues. And first point, apologies for being so dogmatic, because it's true. First point is Derrida. In fact, the Bourdieu. I learned so much from him. Maybe we don't should not underestimate how I believe that the Foucault jealousy, for good or bad reason, towards Derrida was excessive. I find that there was not such a kind of obscurantist terrorism. I believe that he wanted always be right. I completely agree, but I believe that the most of philosophers, and also the most of not philosophers, want to be always right. So that this was, in a sense, confusing, but is the way in which I believe not just my experience, I understand present reality is so much indebted to the Derrida, change other things, and so on. But this was only, a reminiscence, remembering to Bourjac, which in fact was both. Second point is what is obvious. In fact, one of the things we learn, not just only from Derrida, but from philosophy, is that we should not take for granted things that seems to be granted for most of people. But, and this is the third point, we have not to question evidence. Because for me, one should question everything, but for instance, it's pretty sure that Belgium did not invade Germany, whereas Germany invaded Belgium. And if we say that in a sense Germany was invaded by Belgium, we are not so much sophisticated. We create some problems. And I would say that most of postmodern thought was implied in works like saying that in reality Belgium invaded Germany. There is plenty of example of this kind of attitude. Another problem with postmodern thought is not to make difference. You said that it was, you, Emmanuel, said that it was unuseful to say that, to make difference between ontology and epistemology or nature and...
No, not as strong as some people believe it has to be drawn today. I would make this difference. I just don't think it's the ultimate solution for solving all problems.
Yes, yes. I even don't think that make good difference is a solution of all problems, but I'm convinced that making a bad difference of soft difference is not even the solution of solving or problem. Some point, I've lost the list so that I go only on some point. There is, I believe, just to replace the question of responsibility. I believe that no one thinks that postmodern is responsible of what happens now. No one in the world. But they were simply wrong, because they supposed that anti-realism means emancipation. We have the proof, and not just from Trump, but also from the wolf and the lamb. La raison de plus fort est toujours la meilleure. This is not anti-realism is not a way of emancipation, nor about retour à l'ordre. I always hear speaking about retour à l'ordre since I am in the university. I imagine that at the very beginning there was a marvelous disorder, but I was not there. I always find something very ordinated in my life. But, for instance, I don't believe that no one not only believe that, say, Foucault is responsible for Trump. There was a discussion last week in Germany in which someone said, are you saying, not to me, to another, are you saying that Derrida is responsible for Trump?
No, no one said this for several reasons. The same reason that no one considered Nietzsche responsible for Hitler. No one can say such a stupid thing.
But I gave you the quotes. I gave you the quotes. Daniel Dennett says it explicitly. I told you, Poroshenko said it explicitly. I mean, there are tons of people, and even prominent people saying this.
Okay, there are some people. Among them, I am not. Because in your description, you were supposing that I was, in a sense, the most prominent of this silly, stupid crowd. I say they are simply wrong. Okay. This is a slight different reason. Okay. For the same, for instance, take the example of perspectivism. I perfectly agree with your idea of perspectivism, which, by the way, was the description of perspectivism given by Leibniz in Monadology. He says, if I see a city from a perspective or from another perspective, then I cannot see a city from an absolute perspective, but from east to west or from west to and so on. And this is perfectly true and undisputable. Unfortunately, Nietzsche misunderstood Leibniz and transformed it into there are no facts, only interpretation, perspectivism. Not that the quote is not a quote of Yoth, it's a quote of the 80s. So it don't change. I would say the problem is that, yes, he changed idea, but he changed idea every day, which is a problem for a philosopher. He gave a huge quantity of idea. All the idea you can have, you can find it in Nietzsche. No one, I believe, is interested in naive realism. I suppose that... the problem, and this would be really the conclusion of my apology and of the discussion of today. It's really frustrating to be philosopher, and if you consider the philosopher as a kind of policeman that goes and say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is not a good job. But I believe that we have a progressing philosophy. We have not to react. For instance, post-truth or is a sign of a progressing politics. Politics is changing and is a much more progressive, for the good or for the bad, present politics than the politics of mid last century, for instance. This is really evident. I believe that there will be much more political and technological transformation in the world scene than in philosophy. This is a pity. And this is why we want, for instance, new realism, new idealism, is needed something which is new, and I suppose that the best way to obtain something new is not to refer to old stuff like Nietzsche or Kant or people existed many years ago. This is the reason why I think that we have something to learn from post-truth, and is that we should progress in philosophy. I see that John already put his cap. That means that
it's a speech act.
This is the very end. Thank you very much.